The defense ministers of the Atlantic Alliance are also meeting in Brussels this week. Their problem is how to reconcile military needs with a period of growing East-West détente. That report from William McCrory.
The urgent need to maintain NATO defensive strength during East-West negotiations was echoed many times during the day-long meeting of the North Atlantic Defense Planning Committee. In a statement to the defense ministers, and later at a farewell news conference, American Defense Secretary Melvin Laird warned against what he termed wishful thinking by some who believe that there can be successful East-West détente. At the same time, they're cutting back their defense forces. Mr. Laird told newsmen that if anyone in NATO thinks there can be détente without defense, the frightful cost of that delusion will be war. There is no chance for success in MBFR or the SALT negotiations, he said, if NATO nations decide to risk unilateral disarmament. The American Defense Secretary said that he had emphasized to his fellow ministers the continuing buildup of Soviet weapons systems. He singled out Soviet progress in ballistic missiles, conventional weapons, and a massive shipbuilding program. Secretary Laird reaffirmed that President Nixon will ask Congress for a budget to maintain U.S. troops at their present levels in Europe. He said that he fully expected the Congress to approve this request, as it has done for many years in the past. At the end of his news conference, Mr. Laird said that he is leaving NATO as a realist and an optimist. Through partnership, strength, and a willingness to negotiate, he said, we shall have continued peace in Europe. This is William McCrory, Voice of America, Brussels.
Future West European defense needs were also under discussion in Paris. More on that from John Bew.
French Defense Minister Debray made a keynote speech at the Western European Union Parliamentary Assembly following numerous expressions of anxiety on complacency regarding defense provoked by East-West détente. Mr. Debray made clear that there was no complacency in the French government's approach to defense despite its known predilection for East-West détente. But he also reiterated the well-known Gaullist principle that France's defense must be national. France, he pointed out, is always willing to cooperate in defense matters with its European allies. But there can be no question, he said firmly, of integrated European defense. The French defense minister also said France has misgivings about the proposed exploratory talks on East-West force reductions. These, he feels, have not been sufficiently prepared and could have unfavorable political consequences. But the West European parliamentarians adopted a resolution stating that the force reduction talks should have a link in time with the security talks now under discussion in Helsinki. At the end of the day's session, they devoted their attention to a report on violence as a political weapon. Whether it be international terrorism, which the report calls the weapon of minority nationalism, or subversion on the national level. They called upon the seven governments of the Western European Union, Great Britain and the Common Market Six, to promote the universal acceptance of conventions on aircraft hijacking. These governments, the parliamentarians also feel, should pool their experiences in combating terrorism and urge the United Nations to make a detailed study of political violence for discussion by all countries of the world. JW, VOA, Paris.
This is the Voice of America broadcasting from Washington. We are standing by for the launch of Apollo 17, which is now in a hold. Life in Saigon has returned to normal following the heaviest shelling of Tan Son Nhut Air Base since the 1968 Tet Offensive. Wayne Corey reports from the South Vietnamese capital.
53 rockets slammed into and around the big air base on Saigon's northern edge Wednesday morning. 8 South Vietnamese and 1 American airman were killed, and 54 other people, a majority of them civilians, were injured. The rockets landed over a wide area, and although the big American military headquarters next to the base was not hit. Several buildings and four helicopters on the base were damaged. Tantanut Air Base was on maximum alert during the shelling, and all commercial flights into and out of the civilian airport were temporarily halted. No communist ground attacks followed the shelling, but a South Vietnamese military spokesman Wednesday reported 80 incidents throughout South Vietnam during the previous 24 hours, the highest number in nearly 3 weeks. Fighting, however, was generally small scale and scattered. The spokesman also said an unidentified person threw a hand grenade onto the grounds of the French consulate here in Saigon late Tuesday, injuring a guard. Meanwhile, South Vietnamese government officials continue their almost daily meetings to assess the status of the private peace talks in Paris between Dr. Henry Kissinger and North Vietnam's Le Duc Tho. President Nguyen Van Thieu met with his top advisors. The South Vietnamese National Security Council held another meeting, and Prime Minister Tran Tien Kiem conferred briefly on Wednesday with Deputy American Ambassador Charles Whitehouse. No details of any of these meetings have yet been released. At the same time, the semi-official Vietnam press claimed that 1 million South Vietnamese civilians held the largest demonstration yet to protest the terms of the proposed peace agreement. Flags and banners along the main highway in the Delta were said to have expressed support for the South Vietnamese government, which has said the agreement is meaningless until the North Vietnamese agree to withdraw all of their troops from the South. This is Wayne Corey, Voice of America, Saigon.
In Washington, American officials say they are still pressing for China's participation in an arms control arrangement of one kind or another. Robert Sturdivant has the story.
James Leonard, acting director of the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, has underlined the desirability of broadening arms control discussions to include the People's Republic of China. In a letter to Senator William Proxmire, Mr. Leonard wrote that it has long been apparent to Washington that Peking would be a welcome participant in international arms control talks. Senator Proxmire had urged the Arms Control Agency to undertake strategic arms negotiations with China. Mr. Leonard noted that the Nixon administration has taken far-reaching steps to open a dialogue with Peking on matters of mutual interest, including measures leading to a more peaceful and secure world. He said the U.S. is studying various ways in which Washington and Peking can further their common objective of reducing the danger of international military conflict. That was a goal set forth in the Shanghai communique of President Nixon and Premier Zhou Enlai. The U.S. also told the Geneva Disarmament Conference in June 1971 that it would welcome the participation of all nuclear weapon states in arms control and disarmament efforts. Mr. Leonard pointed out that the Chinese government has been cautious in approaching what he called this sensitive subject. So far, Peking has not gone beyond taking part in the annual United Nations disarmament debate. Mr. Leonard said the U.S. will continue to do what it can to broaden participation in arms control efforts and remains receptive to indications from Chinese authorities that they wish to discuss such matters. Robert Sturdivant, Voice of America, the State Department.
Chile's President Salvador Allende has begun an official visit to the Soviet Union. George Halsey reports from our European Bureau.
For 7 years, the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute staff has been collecting and sifting statistics on the world's military spending and weaponry. The results lead to the opinion by Institute Director Frank Barnaby and some of his staff that there is little, if any, slackening of the arms race. The SALT Agreement on Nuclear Arms Limitations, an Institute study says, shifts the superpower competition from quantity to quality of weapons. Another new study anticipates more hundreds of millions of dollars going into military research and development. The private opinion here is that talks on mutual and balanced force reductions will not produce reduction of military forces in Europe, but simply redeployment of troops away from Central Europe. Several broad conclusions are put forward at the Institute in support of a sober and pessimistic view of international arms control. The Soviet Union and United States, it is said, show no real progress in scaling down nuclear or other weaponry. The People's Republic of China seems to be developing a large military machine including nuclear missiles, submarines, and bombers, and seems unlikely to stop in the next few years. Institute studies also indicate that the development of nuclear weapons by even small and poor countries becomes easier and less costly. The knowledgeable assessment at the Institute is that Israel, for example, could assemble a nuclear weapon within 3 to 6 months if the decision were made. The point repeatedly emphasized at the Peace Research Institute is that military technology is expanding at a dazzling pace. Modern weapon systems become more efficient, automated, and less subject to human control. And for the moment, Institute studies suggest there is no prospect the trend will change. Mark Hopkins, Voice of America, Stockholm.
And that was a report from Mark Hopkins, who spoke with the director of a research institute in Sweden, who took a bleak view of the future of any arms control or force reduction talks in Europe. And now for the report on the visit of Chile's President Salvador Allende to the Soviet Union, we go to George Halsey in our European Bureau.
Soviet President Podgorny and Premier Kosygin greeted Chilean President Allende when his special Aeroflot airliner landed him in Moscow precisely on time after a flight from Algeria. Mr. Allende smiled, waved, and shook hands with some of the 200 to 300 people brought to the airport in special buses, reviewed an honor guard, then swept into Moscow in a motorcade. Soviet television carried the arrival ceremony live. Mr. Allende himself earlier described his visit as an effort to ratify Chile's friendship with the Soviet Union and to seek forms of technical cooperation and credits which can help the Chilean economy. A Chilean diplomat in Moscow said economic assistance would be the primary agenda item in talks with Soviet leaders. A correspondent for Czechoslovak television said on the eve of Mr. Allende's visit to Moscow that Chile already had received $463 million credit from the communist countries. More than half of this, he said, had come from the Soviet Union alone. The Czechoslovak correspondent in Moscow said the Soviet Union had granted Chile a single loan of $70 million for purchasing foodstuffs and another $25 million in renewed credits to purchase 3 fishing vessels. In Moscow, Chilean sources said President Allende was seeking further hard currency credits. The money would be used, they said, primarily for mining equipment to make up for what Chile lost in nationalizing United States-owned copper interests. But one Chilean source acknowledged that the Soviet Union is very wary. The source said they don't want to get their fingers burned as they did elsewhere in Latin America and with Egypt, for example. When the Russians build a house, he said, they build it stone by stone. President Allende will go from Moscow to Kiev at the end of the week before flying on to Cuba. He is expected back in Santiago on December 14th. George Halsey, Voice of America, European Bureau.
This is the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the Apollo 17 space mission. For late developments on the mission, which is now in a hold, we return to Cape Kennedy and VOA space correspondent Rhett Turner.
Well, they've moved the mission clock back. They've recycled the clock to T-minus 22. They haven't started counting yet, but it is at T-minus 22. And when we see that countdown begin, then we'll know that we're on the way toward that launch to the moon again. Let me repeat for those of you who may have wondered what happened. At T-minus 30 seconds, the clock stopped because a pressurization system in the third stage of the Saturn V rocket failed to come up to par fast enough. The automatic sequencer was pressurizing the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen in the second and third stages of the Saturn V rocket. At T-minus 30 seconds, a monitoring system detected that the pressurization was not where it should be fast enough. The men in mission control saw this, manually pressurized the tank, but not fast enough for the automatic sequencer. So, the automatic sequencer shut down the count at T-minus 30 seconds. The engineers have analyzed it and are now in the process of recycling to T-minus 22 minutes. And we'll go back when that clock starts again. We'll be 22 minutes from launch. They have our display out here shows the T-minus 22 minutes, but they haven't started counting it yet. The countdown. we can still launch for the next 2.5 hours approximately. There's about that much time in tonight's launch window. Again, we heard from Mission Control just a short time ago that the engineers in Houston, the flight planners, are now cranking into their computer a new launch azimuth. You see, the Earth has turned just a little bit in the last hour in relation to the moon. And so the launch azimuth, when most of this power, this energy, is put into the spacecraft system, during the first 12 minutes, that's the moment of truth. It's when all that energy is put into it, when it sails out into orbit around the Earth, the launch azimuth must be changed to 81.6 degrees, 0.06 degrees. And then I believe that we can still, at this point, I don't think just an hour or so would be enough to cause a real delay in or change in the time schedule for landing on the moon. I believe that can be made up in the 3 days by slightly changing the trajectory, sharpening it slightly. We'll hear of confirmation of that, of course, from Mission Control in Houston, which will control the flight from the moment that the big Saturn rocket lifts past the top of the launch tower. Earlier, we heard Gene Cernan, the commander of this mission, telling you about the overall mission, what the purposes of it were. Now let's go back to Gene and let's hear just a little bit about the man himself. First launch control.
Stand by at the T-minus 22-minute mark. We're hoping to resume the count shortly. The problem has not been resolved. We're continuing to look into it. However, it has been determined that a resolution one way or the other should be able to be made shortly. So right now we are continuing our recycle procedures, hoping to pick up the count perhaps just minutes from now. If the problem is not resolved by the time we reach the T-minus 8-minute mark, after we continue to count down, the clock will be held again. Right now we're continuing the recycling procedures, hoping to pick up shortly at T-minus 22 minutes. We're now T-minus 22 minutes and holding. This is Kennedy Launch Control.
And there's the latest status report from launch control itself. When they pick up the launch sequence, the clock will start, and then we can get down to T-minus 8 minutes before a further decision has to be made on continuing the count. Jim Parisi talked to Gene Cernan in Houston. He's flown before on several other flights. He went to the moon on Apollo 10. He flew in Gemini. And let's hear that conversation where the commander of this flight tells us about himself. Jim?
We're talking with Gene Cernan, who's commander of Apollo 17. Gene, tell us a little about yourself. You were born in Chicago, weren't you?
Well, I was born in Chicago, I guess about 38 years ago, which seems like a long time. I grew up in the western suburbs, about 18 to 20 miles west of Chicago, and went to high school there and then went from there to Purdue University, where I earned a bachelor's degree in engineering and was also in NROTC, was commissioned in the Navy and went from there to Navy flight training. So from that point on, I really didn't spend much time at home, although my mother still lives in the western suburbs of Chicago, where I grew up, as a matter of fact, in the same house. My sister, however, who also grew up, spent most of her time back there, has since moved to Seattle. I spent several years in the, well, I'm still in the Navy, obviously, but going through flight training and spent a great deal of time in Florida, in California, and spent an awful lot of time flying off of aircraft carriers in the Western Pacific, and had an opportunity to go back to school, to the Naval Postgraduate School to get an additional education in engineering, and I did. And fortunate for me at that time is when the National Aeronautics and Space Administration was looking for new astronauts. However, at that time, I really didn't apply for the program because, oddly enough, I thought, from a standpoint of experience, that I didn't have enough in terms of test pilot experience, in terms of total number of flight hours. But it was at that point that NASA actually reduced the requirements, and it allowed a few fellows like myself to be given a chance. And so here I am.
Now you have your own family that will be following the whole flight of Apollo 17, right?
Right. I have a little girl, 9-year-old little girl.
You're not a stranger to space, or for that matter, the area of the moon, at least.
No, I flew on Gemini 9, and that was an Earth orbital mission, as you might recall, for 3 days.
That's back in 66.
66, right. And Tom Stafford and I really sort of, it was a rendezvous research mission. It also was a spacewalk mission. So I had an opportunity, a pretty exciting one, as a matter of fact, to walk around the world a couple times, which is sort of a unique comment, I guess. Following that, in 1969, I flew again with Tom Stafford and John Young, and we flew on Apollo 10. And we did go to the moon, and we did take our lunar module with us and separate. And at that point in time, it was the closest that any man had been to the surface of the moon. And that was quite an experience also. Not just the experience of coming close to the moon, but having the experience of being able to be a quarter million miles away from this Earth and look back and look at our Earth. That, to me, is probably one of the most emotional and beautiful views I've ever seen in my life.
And now with Apollo 17, you'll have your chance for the surface of the moon.
There's a gap of 50,000 feet I'd like to cover. And you know, with a little help, and we've got a lot of it from a lot of good people, and God willing, we'll cover that last 50,000 feet.
Well, the very best. I'm sure you'll enjoy being on the moon.
Well, I'm looking forward to it very much.
Commander of Apollo 17, Gene Cernan. This is Jim Parisi from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, Texas.
There you've heard the man himself who is commanding the flight. He called down to astronaut Bob Parker, who's on capsule communicator duty in the Mission Control Center in Houston. Incidentally, the astronauts in the command craft are talking to Houston, not to Cape Kennedy. And he asked, he says, well, we're sort of in limbo up here. What's happening? What have you decided down there? And Parker filled him in on what the problem was and how they were going to resequence. We just got a report from flight control that the countdown will resume at T-minus 22 minutes on the hour, at 4 hours GMT, about 6 minutes from now. They're going to start the clock again at T-minus 22 minutes. So now it looks like liftoff will be at 22 minutes past the hour, 4 hours 22 GMT, if I've counted that correctly. And at the T-minus 8-minute mark, there is another go, no go in continuing the count. With me still is Don Beatty. Don?
Well, what will be happening once the count picks up again, Rhett, is that they'll continue to look very closely at what the problem was and how the spacecraft and the launch vehicle are reacting to the new count. And if they see any problems, then at the T-minus 8-minute point, they might have to schedule a hold. If everything is looking good at that point, then the count will continue.
And so before that count picks up, let's listen to Jack Schmidt, the second man to land on the moon, as he recorded this conversation about himself and his background, the geologist, the scientist, Jack Schmidt, with Jim Parisi in Houston.
Talking with Dr. Harrison, known more as Jack Schmidt, who is the lunar module pilot of Apollo 17. Jack, tell us a little about your background. Tell us what brought you to be an astronaut.
Well, I guess the chain of circumstances of me becoming an astronaut are just like circumstances in anybody's life. They're tortuous in some respects. I was born in New Mexico in a small mining town. As a matter of fact, my birthplace right now is in thin air, so to speak, in a copper mine. It's town has subsequently been moved and the copper mined out from underneath it. Santa Rita, New Mexico was the town. I grew up in Silver City, New Mexico, again a small mining and ranching town in New Mexico, and spent 17 years of my life there, partly associated with my father, who was also a geologist, what we call an exploration geologist, looking for mineral deposits. Subsequent to that, I went to Caltech, University of Oslo, and Harvard universities on the way to getting a doctorate. And I guess it was while I was in Norway that my first real interest in the space program started to develop from a very general point of view, because that was the time when the Soviet Union launched Sputnik, and it became very clear that the space program was going to be a dominant thought in people's minds, both within our country and certainly within the world from that time forward. After that, after Norway, I was still working on my doctorate degree at Harvard, and that occupied most of my time until it became necessary to look for a way to make a living, to use this fantastic education that I was able to get. And the only thing that really seemed, this was 1964, that seemed to be intriguing to my mind after many years in the academic world was the work that Dr. Eugene Shoemaker had started with the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona, and that where they were starting to do photogeologic mapping of the moon. That is, they were trying to, using photographs from taken from the Earth, to determine the nature of materials and their distribution on the lunar surface in hopes of understanding more about another planet and in relating that understanding to the Earth. And this seemed to be a very exciting thing to me at that time. And so I went to work for Shoemaker and the U.S. Geological Survey. And very shortly thereafter, NASA asked for volunteers for the scientist-astronaut program. And although looking back on it, it was not nearly as logical as it seems now, but it turned out it would be a very logical thing for me to do based on the experience I'd had, limited experience there with the U.S. Geological Survey, and plus the continuing growing concern that space exploration was going to be extremely important for mankind, and in particular for my own country and the traditions it has developed over the centuries, really, that are based, and not in small part, on its history of exploration.
So you were accepted by for the astronaut corps, and that meant going back to school, didn't it?
It did, and I really have never ceased going to school. This whole 7 years now has been one continuous learning process for me, in areas that I never dreamed that I would be studying.
Well, you represent several firsts in the Apollo program, the first scientist to go to the moon, and the first bachelor to go to the moon, too, aren't you?
Yes, Jack Swigert is and was a bachelor when he went around the moon with Apollo 13, but I guess I'll be the first bachelor to land on the moon. That's
right. And you're also the youngest in this particular crew, aren't you?
Yeah, I guess I am the youngest on the crew. I'm not the youngest to fly, though. I believe Rusty Schweigert was a...
I'm sure you're going to enjoy your journey to the moon from an astronaut point of view as well as a geologist point of view. Talking with Jack Schmidt, the lunar module pilot of Apollo 17. And from Houston, Texas, and the Manned Spacecraft Center, this is Jim Parisi.
Of course, that was recorded about a month ago before Jack Schmidt climbed atop the Saturn V rocket out there. Don Beatty and I were just laughing. We know Jack so well. That business of Jack being a bachelor is subject of quite a bit of joking for that fellow. And he's ready to go, and they've started the countdown again, 18 minutes, 54 seconds, and counting. And we'll be back to report that liftoff and continued countdown after this from Washington. This is Rhett Turner at Cape Kennedy.